It's time to think big with Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good lying through your tooth, tall Alaska tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Broadcasting from the studios of a remote cabin outside Bolchitna and streamed worldwide at KFQD.com with podcast streamed at BigAlaskaShow.com. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve and some Big Alaska Show friends. It's Iditarod time with our special guest, author, historian, and humorist Steve Levi. We're featuring another teacher on the trail, Brian Hickox. Plus, an Iditarod update, designed to raise your spirits and not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Oh! Good morning, everyone. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning, and thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. I'm Uncle Steve, along with my good buddy and co-host, Mike Ford. Mike Ford, we have an Iditarod winner.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yes, and neither of us was up at that hour, but we did get a winner.
I was going to go into our coffee spot, but I think because of this is a special event, this time there wasn't any snow here.
Nope.
And so they went to Fairbanks. I understand it's a longer route, right?
Right. But it also, the most interesting part of that is you go through Nenana, and the original serum run began at Nenana. So it's kind of like hearkening back to the original serum run for this year's race.
This year was a special Iditarod, and you've got some information about our winner. Tell us about it.
Well, Jesse Holmes, this is his eighth Iditarod, and he'd come in third a couple of times. But so he came across under the burled arch, the redone burled arch, by the way. This is the first time that this one's been used. It signifies the end there on Front Street Nome. And he came in under the burled arch at 2:55:41 this morning with 10 dogs in harness for a total time on the trail of 10 days, 14 hours, 55 minutes and 41 seconds. So Matt Hall's made it in, and so has Paige Drobny. But Jesse Holmes, taking home this year, $57,200, and his total winnings over his eight Iditarods, Uncle Steve, is now $241,794. Congratulations to Jesse Holmes, and carrying the red lantern, which we always are appreciative of here on the Big Alaska Show, because it kind of signifies our status in the broadcast world. Jenny Rodwig of Fairbanks, she and her husband, Michael, have 30 years of mushing between them, and they're owners of the Sage Mountain Kennels there near Fairbanks.
For more information, to get all the information of the finishers and all that stuff, go to Iditarod.com. And today, our show is about Iditarod, but a lot of people don't know what the Iditarod history of it is. But we brought in Steve Levi, author, historian, humorist, and he's going to be telling us about the stories about. So you get a good foundation of the history of the Iditarod and the serum run.
Oh, and let's also remind them, Uncle Steve, because I'm sure you'll be putting it up here later today or tomorrow or sometime soon. And I resent you the videos of when Balto and Togo were together at the Anchorage Museum a few years ago. And that had been the first time that they had been near each other in proximity since the serum run. So go check that out.
And I noticed one thing about them. They seemed well-fed because they were stuffed.
Yes, they were.
But of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska Show out the right way, brother.
And we go down a different path after you have some of this stuff, let me tell you.
Folks, the key to a successful radio show, especially an early Saturday morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. And nothing stronger than Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. Made from an old secret family recipe, Big Alaska Show Blend packs a powerful cup of coffee that's been handed down from generation to generation with the same unique flavor it started with. That's because it is the same cup it started with. And one taste says it all. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt, Big Alaska Show blend. The intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
Pour me a cup, it's time to get up and face the world, my friend. Pour me a cup, I can't get enough of that Big Alaska Show blend.
And that's how we roll here at the Big Alaska Show. But stick around, we have more Big Alaska Show coming up. And you can hear our show streamed and get podcasts at bigalaskashow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. With the Iditarod coming to a close, lest we forget, many people, although fans of the Iditarod, don't know the history of the Iditarod other than it commemorates the 1925 serum run to Nome. But beyond that, not much. That's why we like to go to author, historian, and humorist, Steve Levi. We have some of Steve's books in our Big Alaska Show book review section at bigalaskashow.com, and we hooked up with Steve to give us a little tutorial about the Iditarod and the 1925 serum run to Nome. One of the things we like on the Big Alaska Show are stories, especially historical stories, and we like them whether they're true or not. So who better to fit that description for telling us great historical stories, whether they're true or not, is our good buddy, historian, Stephen Levi. Steve Levi, the reason you're here is a couple of things. One, I want to talk about your book that we covered the last time, just to kind of get a little update on it. But the other thing is with the Iditarod going on, you know, we've talked about the serum run of 1925 because that's what the Iditarod commemorates. But I realized I really don't know that much about the serum run. So who better to go to than our Big Alaska Show historian, which we've adopted you, man. You drew a crowd for us. So my question is, where would you start with the 1925 serum run?
Let's first start with Iditarod, because we're talking about things that are true and things that you are told is true, which probably aren't. If you punch up the Iditarod on Wikipedia, it'll tell you that gold was first discovered on Christmas Day in 1908. And if you spent any time in the interior of Alaska during the winter, you know there's not a lot of running water in Christmas time. So yeah, they may have said that they found gold on Christmas Day in 1908. I'd be real cautious about believing that. I think probably what happened was that they found the gold earlier and that they went to another town and were drinking up and saying, hey, you want to come to Iditarod because we found gold. And by the way, we own all the land. And so if you come, you can buy land from us and be part of a boom town. So I think that's probably the way that it went.
So it was really a marketing ploy.
Yes, I would say so. But that's what boom towns were. And the most important thing is they say, well, show us the gold that you found. You know, and then these guys would open their hands and they would show gold. And that's pretty much the way it happened, because the next year in 1909, Iditarod starts to boom. Mm-hmm. And it will be around for until the 1930s. Because the gold is there and the gold is going to last enough time to get them to have the boom town to go. Mm-hmm. So Iditarod is a boom town, and it starts in about 1910 when the steamship comes up and brings enough material to go ahead and build buildings and a dock. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty vibrant community until about 1930, and then the gold ran out. And when the gold ran out, that was it. And the town just kind of vanished. They tore the buildings down and dragged them to Flat. That's another town that no longer exists. But that's pretty much the way it was in Alaska. What happens is you were there until the gold runs out. And after the gold runs out, then you run out too.
Well, and the other thing I was thinking of is how it ties into the pandemic that we have today and kind of trying to draw comparisons if there's anything that can relate between now and back then.
Well, it's exactly the same. What happened is that they need serum and they don't have serum. And so they got to get it from someplace. And so there's this mad rush to get it in. A couple of little things, though, is that Nome did have serum for diphtheria, but the serum that they had was old. And they didn't think that the serum would work. So what they did is they needed new serum. And the only serum they could get was from Anchorage, which was a long way away. For those listeners who are not Alaskans, you have to understand that around September 15th, the Bering Sea freezes. And when the Bering Sea freezes, you've got 15 feet of ice, which means you cannot bring ships north of the Aleutians. So when Nome needed serum, it couldn't come in by ship. And if you, once again, if you live in Alaska, then you know what it's like. Flying in the Nome is not like getting on a plane and flying there. Today you can do it because there are 727s, 737s.
Right, yeah.
In 1925, there were little tiny planes that were very dangerous to fly, and they just could not fly the serum in. The only thing they could do is to bring it in by dog sled. And so what they did is they took, is we're talking 20 pounds. We're talking something about the size of a duffel bag. And they put it on the train, and they took the train to Nenana. And then from Nenana, you had about 30 teams of mushers that were going to take it from Nenana all the way to Nome. It took them about 8 days to make it there. Don't forget, these guys are running serum, and the temperature out there is well below zero.
Yes.
So when the serum gets into Nome, they've got to warm it up. It's odd that they would have to warm up serum.
Yeah, in that it's...
it's I mean, there's a lot of coordination that has to be done.
My understanding was they sort of did like a Pony Express style as far as the sleds, the mushers. Is that how that went?
Yeah, and don't forget, this is early in the days of radio. So, I mean, today the Pony Express is pretty sophisticated because everybody knew the trails and everybody knew where the other horses are going to be. These guys are going through pretty bad weather. You're never really sure if the pass is open. You have to take an alternate route. So it's not as simple as saying, well, they went from point A to B to C to E to E like that. Mm-hmm. It is a pretty sophisticated way of getting serum into Nome, and it's very dangerous. You're talking about 30 guys, and each guy has about 12 dogs. So it's a large effort. It's a Herculean effort.
I remember it was something like 800 miles, and it wasn't a direct route. It was not a nonstop route, and that's a long, long way. How many days they do this thing in?
They did it in about 8 days.
Wow. But by Pony Express, it's basically they're doing a relay. Is that how that was?
674 miles total. That's how far they took the serum, 674 miles.
I wonder what the logistics were on that and who was planning that stuff out, Steve.
Well, that was probably all coordinated by radio, and it had to have been coordinated by the hospital in Nome, because they had to know the serum was coming. They had to get their patients ready to be injected. And just like today, what happens is those most at risk first would get the vaccine first. I mean, wow. This is just like COVID-19, but it's 1925 and it's serum, diphtheria serum.
Nome was really at risk of being completely wiped out by this.
Talking about a very small community where everybody knows everybody else and they see each other and they're rubbing elbows every day. So if you want to talk about, there weren't any face masks in those days, and you couldn't social distance in those days. So, you know, when the diphtheria hit, you know, it could wipe out the whole city. That's true.
Stick around, we have more Steve Levi right after this important message. As we say, anyone who gives us money, we call friend. And the more money, the better the friend. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
Just want to remind you, if you miss our broadcast, we have podcasts at BigAlaskaShow.com. We've been listening to Steve Levi talking about the Iditarod and the 1925 serum run to Nome. And here's part two of that interview with Steve Levi.
We always hear about Balto, the hero dog. Tell me a little bit about what you know about Balto.
Well, this is one of those odd things, is that, you know, we're talking about 30 mushers that have about 12 to 14 dogs each. So you can do your math and see how many dogs there are. Balto is the dog, is the lead dog that comes into Nome with the serum. And he is coming in with a musher by the name of Gunnar Haskassen. And so it's, Balto is the lead dog coming in with the serum. He gets all of the credit. There's a statue of Balto in New York. And if, in Anchorage, if you happen to be driving down Wisconsin, there is a park to Balto. You know, and so it was kind of like, you know, I mean, the guy that should get the credit for a lot of the running is Leonard Seppala, because he's the one that actually did the organizing. And legend has it that he hated that Balto got all of the publicity. His dog.
What was the guy's name that was driving Balto with a serum?
His name is Gunnar Kassen.
Yeah. See, our theory is because Balto was easier to pronounce, that he got all the recognition he did. So I can see how Leonard Seppala would resent that. But wasn't there another dog?
Was Togo, the dog that Seppala's dog was Togo.
Ah, so there was sort of a comp, there was sort of a, you know.
Oh yeah, you're getting into minutia here, you know. I mean, because, you know, these guys, this thing was put together on the fly. Leonard Seppala put it together on the fly, got the mushrooms together, and they coordinated it through, certainly by radio, because that's the only way you could do it in those days.
Yeah.
The important thing to remember here is this, you're talking the middle of winter, you're talking storms, you're talking extreme danger, and these guys did it. I mean, it is really a saga of heroism.
Yes. And going back to the radio, you know, our Big Alaska Show airs on KFQD, and I believe that was the radio station that was going on at that time. I'd have to double check, but
I'm not really sure, but Cap Lathrop went up and started the first radio station in Alaska, and I would think it was in the 1930s.
Yeah,
I know that they were struggling until the Second World War, and then they talked to the military and said, hey, you should give us all your business and all your equipment so we could reach all of Alaska. And that was really the start of what we now call commercial radio.
I know KFQD has been around since the 20s. I'll have to go now and research and see if they were involved in any way in this serum run. Be interesting.
Yeah, I don't know, but these guys, however they did it, it was coordinated. And don't forget, a lot of these guys that were running ran the mail. So what happens is they knew the trails. So these are just guys that were pulled in and said, we're going to run this direction. I mean, these guys knew the trails, and a lot of them have probably done them quite a few times. So they were familiar with the trails.
So the serum gets to Nome, and the city of Nome was saved. There's so much good story in this 1925 serum run, and especially right now that we have this special Iditarod going on during this pandemic. And you mentioned Flat earlier, and this golden loop of the Iditarod goes around Flat, and hence the name Golden Loop. What do you know about Flat?
Flat is a fascinating community. I'm going to take you back to the 1930s, about 10 years after the Iditarod serum run, is that you've got a guy, a pilot, America's best known pilot, is a guy by the name of Wiley Post. He will eventually die with Will Rogers in a crash up in Point Barrow.
Right, yeah.
And Wiley Post is trying to fly, he's trying to be the first man to fly around the world alone. And he has made it all the way across Europe, all the way across Russia. He's flying in Alaska, and he gets lost. He does not know where he is. He knows where he's supposed to be, and he's flying around, and he sees this tower sticking out of the clouds, and he lands, and it's Flat. And as he lands, he breaks his landing gear in Flat. And everybody in Flat is just thrilled to see Wiley Post. Everybody's been following him on the radio, and here he is, and his plane has a broken landing gear, and they said to him, go in there, sleep, and we will put your landing gear together.
Wow.
So Wiley Post is catching up on some badly needed sleep. These miners out there, these guys don't work on airplanes.
They're out there. We'll take care of it.
This plane together, they just got to get it enough together so that he can fly into Fairbanks where it can really get put together. So Wiley Post sleeps for about 6 hours. He gets out and the guy says, hey, you'll be able to take off and land, but don't try it twice. And so he'll fly from flat into Fairbanks to have the repairs. And from there, he set the record by flying around the world. First person to fly around the world alone.
Wow. Jeez. In Flat, Alaska. They should be talking about this. Only on the Big Alaska Show are we hearing this story. I haven't heard any on the Iditarod stuff.
The big thing about Alaskans is they don't like to hear about history. And I said, oh, it's boring. No, it's not. It's fascinating. You just haven't listened to the right story.
Absolutely.
Again, you can find some of Steve's books in our Big Alaska Show book review section at bigalaskashow.com. By the way, if you come across an author you feel might fit well in our book review section, email us. Just go to our website and you'll see the contact button. And now, part three with Steve Levi.
Now, I want to segue into your book, The Human Face of the Alaska Gold Rush, written by Steve Levi. Hey, we had you on the show last time, and you can go to bigalaskashow.com and check out Steve's book, and you can hear his podcast. So that's been a little bit ago. How's it going with that book?
What's really pretty good is because the more people get in touch with me, they tell me stuff that I didn't know. And then I look it up and find out, well, gee, how come I didn't put that in the book? You know, but there's all kinds of stuff that's out there, and people tell me about, you have to understand there are all these boom towns that existed and they disappeared. And those people went on and they kept diaries and letters and stuff like that. And they went to their grandkids and their grandkids' kids. And all of a sudden this book comes out and they say, well, how come you didn't do anything on such and such town? And I'm going, well, I've never even heard of it and I can't find it. And they say, well, my dad was there. My great grandfather was there for 3 years and he had a partner there. Da, da, da. And they tell me these little stories, but it's really nice. But it's kind of like, do you realize how many boom towns have gone?
Right. Just, yeah.
And bust and nobody's ever heard of them. And some of them, you know, and some of them are just spots on the map. When I went to Candle, and Candle is a town that doesn't exist anymore. And people just walked away from it. And I walked through the town and unless you know it's there, you'd never be able to find it because they got trees are growing up through the buildings and there are no roads there.
But there's still structures.
There are still structures, but you can't get into them because they're full of trees and brushes. Okay. But there are a lot of towns like that across Alaska, and people just walked away, and that was it.
And that was called Candle?
It's Candle. It's outside of McGrath.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. What's Flat like now?
There's nothing there. I mean, there's, you know, the buildings are gone. Usually when people left a boomtown, if they were going someplace else, they took the buildings apart and took the buildings with them. It's not like they just walked away. Okay. A lot of times, if a town goes ghost, yeah, a lot of times they'll just leave. But if there's a new, gold find reasonably close or on a river, what they'll do is they'll take the buildings apart and move with them. This is one of those stories about Alaska. During the Second World War, we had military bases all over Alaska. And then as soon as World War II finished, then all of the local people went into these bases and they just took the buildings. Kotzebue, half of Kotzebue after the war was old military buildings that they had stripped out of Port Clarence, which is over on the coast.
Yeah. One of the things we covered the last time with you that's in your book, we covered the Nome and the Fairbanks, but we didn't cover the Southeast Juneau area. We touched on it just a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about the Juneau Gold Rush?
Well, you have to understand that Alaska, and there is the Alaska Gold Rush, but all three of the centers of what you would call were the big towns that survived, you know, are completely different. Nome, all of the gold that people talk about comes from on the beach. And in Fairbanks, it comes from dredges, you know, because you'd have to get a dredge. But in Juneau, all of the gold is in the mountains. And Juneau is a unique mining story because if you think about mining in the lower 48, they know the gold is in this mountain. And so what they do is they take these miners and they take them up to the top of the mountain and they put them in elevators and they take them down into the mountain. And then they start drilling for gold and they put all of the offal and the fill and everything else in on ore carts and bring them back to the surface.
Oh, I see. It's that typical one you see with the rails and they're pushing the cart with,
In Juneau, you started at the bottom of the mountains. So what happens is Juneau was an incredibly valuable mine is because you didn't have all of these expenses. These guys basically started at seaside and kind of worked their way up. And as they're working their way up, the tunnels are at an angle. So what happens is you don't have to worry about getting, you know, you don't have to worry about having, you can't let them roll out, but it makes it a lot easier to bring the heavy gold out. And when they started the mine, if you've been to Juneau, if you go to where the mine is today, you can see the tunnels against the mountain. That was right on the water. And so what they did is they just started dumping all of the fill and the boulders and the gravel and the rocks. They just dumped them out of the mine. And over the years, that became Juneau. So what happens is when you start walking in downtown Juneau around, you're not walking on land that was part of Juneau when they discovered gold. That's all been dumped there by the mine. So don't forget, that mine started in 1880, and it doesn't close until the Second World War. So you're talking like 60, 70 years worth of gold coming out of that mine.
Tailings, man. Juneau sits on tailings.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. And I was trying to think, there was a character in it that was that started this whole thing. Wasn't an Indian chief?
Chief Cowie had been promised blankets. He was, if you could show George Pills, P-I-L-Z, if you could show George Pills where there was gold, then George Pills would give you something like, you know, like 50 blankets. And so Cowie went to Sitka where George Pills was and says, hey, there's gold here in what's going to be called Juneau. And George Pills says, well, I've got all my good people out there looking for gold. I only have a couple of drunks, you know, Joe Juneau and Frank Harris. They went and Joe Juneau and Frank Harris got as far as what now is now Juneau. And they took all of their supplies and they sold them to a fishing company for booze. And they spent 2 weeks on a binge. Then they went back and told George Pills that there wasn't any gold. And what they didn't know is that Cowie had trailed them. And Cowie said to Pills, hey, these guys didn't even get out of the boat. You know, so Pills said to him, you're going to go back and you're going to go with Chief Cowie. You're going to go to exactly where he says to go, or you're not going to get paid and you get no more booze. And so these guys did, and they got dragged up to what is now the mine out there on Gold, what's up there on Gold Hill, you know, and that's how Juneau started right there. But it started by a bunch of drunks.
Perfect. I always love having you come back for the Big Alaska Show and just talk history, because you're right, it is interesting. Tell us the title of your book and how we can find it.
The name of the book is The Human Face of the Alaska Gold Rush, and you can find it by going to authormasterminds.com and look for my picture, Steve Levi.
Steve, a name you can trust. Go to BigAlaskaShow.com. Steve Levi's book is our Big Alaska Show book review section, and it's got a podcast of him talking about it. I mean, there's no reason you shouldn't have one of these books. Steve, we'll bring you back. There's so much more ahead of us.
Anytime you want to talk to me about history, you let me know.
Steve Levi, our Big Alaska Show historian. A Big Alaska Show, thank you, and much success.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve here with co-host Mike Ford. The Iditarod education outreach is far-reaching and very popular with our young people. We've been featuring former teachers on the trail in our show these last couple of weeks. One teacher on the trail we wanted to be sure to bring back is the 2019 teacher on the trail, Brian Hickox. Here we caught up with Brian when he was newly selected to the position and had just arrived in Anchorage. and sounded like this.
Tell me your name and how do you spell your name?
So my name is Brian Hickox, B-R-I-A-N-H-I-C-K-O-X.
You're the teacher that they've awarded to go on the Iditarod. Now, what's the official title of your position with the Iditarod?
So the official title is called the 2019 Iditarod Teacher on the Trail. And what I'll be doing is while the race is going on, I'll be traveling to various checkpoints, and I'll be making observations about what's going on with the race. And I'll be posting on the Iditarod education page lessons and reflections for teachers and students to use from all over the country.
And where do you live and what do you teach?
So I live in Weymouth, Massachusetts, but I teach in Canton, Massachusetts, the Galvin Middle School. I teach 8th grade English.
What process did you go through to be awarded this position?
So the process was, it was a long one, but it was a great one. So you had to submit a very long application with a whole bunch of different sections, and if you're selected, you're one of the 3 finalists in the country. And as a finalist, you come out here a year in advance. You have interviews, you put on presentations at the Educators Conference, and from there, if you're selected, you officially become the teacher on the trail in the at the Musher sign-up meeting in late June.
Were your students excited?
Oh, my students were absolutely pumped. My teachers were pumped. I have a very supportive school community. We all got together and rallied.
You need swag, brother. You got to take advantage of this moment. You know, here's your 15 minutes of fame. Have you thought about like a t-shirt or some buttons or some pens?
I have thought about definitely a sweatshirt would be sweet. Maybe some business cards to make myself look a little bit more official. I'm growing a beard. That's my swag going on right now.
So we can follow you going to the website. Is there a particular link that we go to find that out?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's the Iditarod Education tab. And also if you go to the main Iditarod website, on the right side, you'll see Teacher on the Trail. And if you click that, you'll see me and standard-based lessons and reflections and photos. So it's a great resource for fans, teachers, and students.
And by the way, if you encounter a moose along the way, get all to all fours and act like a predator.
That's the game plan.
What a great guy.
Now, 2 years later, after Brian had time to go through the experience and time to digest it, we caught up with Brian again.
Our guest, Brian Hickox, had the distinguished privilege of being teacher on the trail in 2019. We met him at a press conference prior to the Iditarod running, and we did a little interview with Brian. That was 2 years ago, and we've asked Brian to join us back again to talk about his experience. Would you please give a warm Big Alaska Show welcome to the 2019 Iditarod Teacher on the Trail, Brian Hickox. Now you're back in Massachusetts. You're still teaching. Let's talk about the 2019 Teacher on the Trail. Tell us what that is and what its purpose is.
So first of all, thank you for having me. I'm excited to reflect and be with you and your great show. And so I appreciate being back here. Teacher on the Trail is a position through the Iditarod Education Program, and essentially the Teacher on the Trail, I like to call them almost an educational reporter who connects with students and teachers from around the world, so not just the United States. And what they're doing is they have a one-year position where they are creating lessons, posting journals, and they're bringing students and teachers into the Iditarod experience. And that position lasts from June to June for the year in which you are awarded the position.
Now, how did you become the teacher on the trail? What process did you have to go through? I remember briefly talking to you about it when we first met. You said it was pretty extensive.
Extensive is the correct word. The application process was very thorough, very long, but it was actually a good process. You do a lot of reflection on your teaching practices. Pretty much you have to put together a binder and respond to all these different prompts. You have to get letters of recommendation. You have to create a video introducing yourself to the selection committee. And after the review takes place, they select 3 finalists throughout the country. And what the 3 finalists do is they travel to Alaska before the start of the Iditarod. And there's typically a winter's educators conference that takes place. So the 3 finalists put on a presentation for the conference. They have various interviews. They're under observation. They create a website and post daily. And they're also put up to a challenge that they don't know what that challenge is ahead of time.
What was your challenge? Do you remember?
Our challenge was right when the finalists arrived, and myself included, we were brought to Campbell Creek Estuary.
Yes.
And we were told to walk around and just take in all observations. And then we were brought into downtown Anchorage where the Fur Rondi events were taking place. And we were given the task of creating Iditarod themes math-based lessons for kids in grades kindergarten, third, fifth, ninth, and 12th grade. So not being a math teacher, I think that was the idea behind it, is what could we put together.
And did you meet the other two finalists?
I did. Very, very nice teachers, you know, both passionate about the Iditarod, and they were more tenured than I was in regards to how long they've been teaching, but it was great getting to know them.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What a disappointment to go through all that and not be selected. How did you hear about this position in the first place?
I have a colleague and a really good friend, Maureen Hollins, who teaches eighth grade English at the same school that I do. And she actually attended the winter conference that the Iditarod Education Department puts on. And when she, and this took place prior to me meeting her. And when after I met her, she said, hey, you know, I heard about this opportunity that I think you would be great at, and you should take advantage of this and apply for it. And long story short, that's what I did. And, you know, I was able to win that. It's unbelievable.
How did she know to pick you? I mean, you're an English teacher. Do they, you know, this, do you have an interest in dogs, or is there something that triggered that? Why she picked you?
I do absolutely love dogs. One of the ways that I bring the Iditarod into my classroom, and she does as well, is we teach The Call of the Wild, written by Jack London. So it's really easy to make the connections and kind of get the kids interested if we can show them this race and have them pick mushers. And that's a fun way to get the kids excited about reading.
That's interesting. And now, how long were you on the trail?
So what's cool about the finalists, being a finalist and then being selected, is this brought me the opportunity to go to Alaska four different times. So I went to Alaska as the finalist in 2018. And then after I had been selected as the winner, I went in the summer of 2018. There's a summer teachers conference that takes place at Vern Halter's Dream a Dream sled dog location on Wasilla. And that's where the formal position was given to me, at the Musher sign up picnic.
Wow.
So after my summer experience, I went back home, and then I came during the 2019 Iditarod. And I came about mid-February, and prior to the race, part of the responsibilities of the teacher on the trail is to go to the Anchorage and Wasilla and Mat-Su area and go to the different schools and make presentations on behalf of the Iditarod. And then also when the Iditarod Education Winter Conference takes place, you're presented there as well. But after that, I was on the trail until the race ended, and I ended up flying back home to Massachusetts about late March.
What were your responsibilities when you were on the trail? What kind of stuff did you do?
So every single day was different because you never knew what to expect. But my responsibilities did entail me posting every single day, at least once on the website. And, you know, I try to post interesting stories, funny moments, and just create these learning opportunities that students can learn from and that teachers can follow me on a daily basis. And I try to give them lessons on every single post that I put on the website so they can get as much out of the race that I can provide for them.
You were on the trail. I mean, did you go to all the points, or where did you go?
As it is every single year, weather dictates, you know, when you can fly and where you can go. That particular year that I was there, in regards to flying weather, the conditions were a little tough. But I ended up going to, I was certainly at the start of the race, but I ended up at Nikolai, Tocotna, McGrath, Unalakleet, Nome, Safety, and White Mountain. So I ended up at a lot of the checkpoints.
Wow. What an experience, pal.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And we traveled by Bush Airplane. And I also had the unique opportunity of, after making it to Nome, I was on one of the snow machines, one of the Trailbreaker snow machines. And I got to spend a day with one of the photographers, Julian Schroeder, that year. And we were using the snow machines going from Nome to Safety and seeing the mushes firsthand on the Bering Sea coast, and that was an unbelievable experience.
That is incredible. Spending a day on a snow machine, I can recommend one thing: Motrin. Lots of Motrin. It's amazing how sore you can get on those, isn't it?
It is a workout that I wasn't anticipating, but I was soaking in every single second of it because it truly was unbelievable.
Vern Halter, he and I met several years ago. Here's this guy from South Dakota. He was an attorney originally. He got away from it. But anyway, Vern and I ran into each other. He and I were karaoke judges at the Alaska State Fair. And I said, I didn't know you could sing. He says, I can't. So that's awesome. You got to see Vern. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy. And Cindy Abbott, Marsha Cindy Abbott, she was there throughout every time I was at Vern Halter's as well. And she's a pretty remarkable person. You know, I did a rod finisher, and she's summited Mount Everest. So pretty inspirational person.
Speaking of that, when you look at mushers and dogs, was there anything about that surprised you about the dogs and surprised you about the mushers?
What's cool about the mushers, you know, maybe compared to a lot of other sports, is these mushers are really, really nice people. They're approachable. They're smart. They'll speak with you. They'll give you the time of day. A lot of them are your just everyday persons, and they have typical jobs throughout the year. And they're just really, really nice people. The dogs are remarkable. The dogs, they really are athletes. And hearing them when they're almost, you know, they know when they're going to be harnessed up and how excited they get. And they're jumping 4 or 5 feet off the ground and they're howling. And to see how much they actually enjoy and love and live for it, it's an exciting moment because until you see it firsthand, you truly don't understand. You can watch all the videos, but you really don't understand and pick up how much they love it until you see it firsthand.
Yeah, and how strong they are.
Very strong.
And I'm sure you did this ride with in the four-wheeler during the summer with the dogs.
We did do that, and seeing the dogs especially respond to the voice commands is unbelievable. Actually, when I was in Nome, when I made it to the end of the race and, you know, I had some downtime, I was able to actually get on the runners of a sled, and I was actually able to have a team of 8 to 10 dogs. And that was a experience as well. I mean, that gave me the bug. I'm like, man, I want to be a musher now, you know?
To me, it's like a really long isometric every day. And not only physically, but mentally.
Mushers always need to adapt and change. And I think teaching is very similar to that, especially this past year. There's a lot of adapting and modifying and, you know, making ends meet.
And we'll be right back right after this shameless plug for our bucks. I mean, Brian's important. Don't get me wrong. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized sales agent for Xerox in Alaska. Call Mike Ferris or visit him anytime at aesalaska.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show with my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. Education is a major part of the Iditarod, and we caught up with the 2019 Iditarod teacher on the trail, Brian Hickox. And this is part two of our interview with Brian. You were the 2019 teacher on the trail for the Iditarod. How did the students respond to you? Tell us a little bit about the students.
So on a personal connection with my students and my community, it was actually a really kind of humbling experience. And the students in my school were very supportive. The community was all on board. Parents were on board. And in fact, the students, when I write from my application process, were part of that as well. And they were in the video, and it was just really cool. And after being selected, my school had a send-off rally for me. The kids put together an Alaska-themed mural that they painted in the main hallway. So when you walk into my school, you see a big mural of me in Alaska. And we did keep in contact while I was over there. And, you know, the kids were following the race and I would shoot emails and updates. So that was unbelievable. And that was really rewarding to have that, to be able to bring the kids into that. And I certainly had a lot of connections with kids throughout the country as well. And like I said, even beyond. And I would Zoom in with classes and put on presentations and receive emails from kids and students, and teachers, and, you know, give them responses as well. So that was really cool.
What kind of questions did they have for you, Brian?
A lot of the kids, as you can imagine, are immediately interested in the dogs. You know, what color are they? How big are they? How fast do they run? What do they eat? How are they taken care of? Which are all great questions. And what I have found as well is that the older that the kids are, a lot of them actually start thinking about the logistics. You know, what are the rules? What are the strategies? How does the time differential work? And what did they do in the off season to train? So it's pretty cool to see the different interests and in the different things as the kids get older.
Interesting. You are really a celebrity. I mean, they hail you as you come into, they've got a mural, they got all this stuff. And that was 2019. When 2020 came around, was there interest for you speaking more? Did you still continue that kind of dialogue within students during that time?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm always reflecting on the experience and sharing that with the kids. And what's been really rewarding is seeing that the kids were actually interested in, you know, the students who I had that particular year are now high schoolers. And many of them shoot me emails or messages, especially when it's around the race time. And they're saying, hey, you know, who do you think is going to win this year? And so that's pretty cool.
What a remarkable experience. And to connect with kids as an educator, were there things that came out of the educational experience that brought more value to it than you thought there would be?
There are a lot of real life connections that you can make with the Iditarod. And in particular, you know, there are a lot of different traits and values that you can teach as well. You know, perseverance, resilience, adapting, problem solving, setting goals. So there's a lot that you can bring in. And even the experience that I had, there's a lot of that as well. So I get to share that with the kids. Hey, you know, I saw this opportunity and I took advantage of it. And here's what I had to do to get it. And here's who helped me. And here's what I got out of it. So those are great lessons that you can teach the kids as well. And those are lifelong lessons that can really mold and change you as a person.
Wow. That's really cool. Now you've got a couple of years to go back and look at it. But when you look back on this experience, what are some of the memories that jump out to you about this experience, Brian?
First and foremost, I honestly feel incredibly fortunate and lucky having had this experience. There's a whole lot of collective memories that I have that are now cherished memories. The respect that I have for mushers and their dogs has significantly increased seeing them firsthand and what they do. And that's been powerful. I love the history behind the Iditarod and the history of sled dogs. And that's why Joe Reddington Sr., the father of the Iditarod, started the race to preserve the history of the sled dogs in honor of the old mail trails and things like that.
Really appreciate you taking the time, Brian. It's really a pleasure to meet you. And let's give Brian Hickox, the 2019 Iditarod Teacher on the Trail, a big Alaska Show thank you and much success.
So that's our show. 5 years ago, the Iditarod was the very last professional sport to shut down when the pandemic hit. It was so new, we didn't know what we were dealing with. But we made it, just like this year's with no snow and moving the restart to Fairbanks. Alaskans did it, just like Alaskans did in 1925 to save the town of Nome. And glad we have teachers on the trail like Brian to spread the tale to a new generation. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank our guests, Steve, Brian, and Aaron, for joining us. We want to thank you for listening, and we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts at 6251 Tunnel, or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com, and Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee to cut through the early morning fog. Visit BigAlaskaShowBlend.com. If it's Big Alaska guests, Big Alaska adventures, and no good line through your tooth-tall Alaska tail, it's gotta be the Big Alaska Show. Have a great week, everybody.